Coming up today, we have 10 important storylines and things to watch over the final 10 days of the NBA regular season, and we took a bunch of your mailbag questions. That's coming up now with Tom Haverstraw. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connell Show. We are live today across the internet, and coming on the show once again on Friday is Tom Haverstraw. Tom, what's up, man? How you doing?
Dude, I'm good. We're live, man. This is awesome.
We're live, and there are 10 days remaining in the NBA regular season. So we're going to talk about 10 important things you got to know down the final stretch here. And Tom, I want you to start us off because we watched an amazing Lakers-Warriors game last night. I would assume number one thing on your list has something to do with that game we saw last night.
Yeah, Steph Curry has entered the top five MVP chat. What a performance from Steph. 37 points coming off of a 52-point stunner the other night. Steph Curry, the gravity that he has on the floor is insane. Still to this day, at age 37. And Tim Bontemps, our friend from ESPN.com, does his straw poll at the quarter mark of every season. And the final one came out this week. And Steph Curry is 12th in the MVP vote. And I do not understand it. I mean, last night was just an exclamation point on what he means to this team. And what we're seeing is Steph Curry is an afterthought in the MVP race. I think that's so unfair, KOC. I was one of three writers who put Steph Curry as the number five on my fake MVP ballot. I was looking to see if he would be top five. And it turns out there's only three writers, three votes for him at the five slot. And then, of course, he does the 52 and the 37 and gets big wins. So I just feel like what he did, the gravity that he has offensively with Bajemski lighting up the Lakers, and all of it is because of all the attention over to number 30. And he's still doing it at a high level. The Golden State Warriors had 140 offensive rating when Steph Curry was on the floor. The Lakers didn't know what to do with him.
You know, I think that fifth spot for the MVP ballot, totally up for grabs. Like, I don't know how Tim Bontemps determines the MVP straw poll guys who get chosen for that. I think sometimes it's random. Every time it's different. Tim goes throughout the year. Sometimes he asks me, sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes I'm sure he asked you. Sometimes he doesn't ask you. It's different every time, it seems like. So with that fifth spot, it's no clear answer. Could be Mitchell. Could be a bunch of different people that we end up selecting for that. So I think for Golden State on the floor, with them ultimately, Steph playing at this level right now, Tom, in that game last night, the way they've closed the season, the argument is going to be super, super strong for him to actually get the fifth spot. But for the Warriors, the team, they looked like the better team than the Lakers in that game. And now Luka did not play well. Luka, of course, got crossed up by Steph on that ISO at the top of the three-point line. He looked terrible defensively. Luka did not match LeBron's effort and intensity level in that game on either end of the floor. Lakers didn't shoot the ball well either. Do you view that as a one game, you know, off night for Luka and the Lakers, or do you view that as another sign that the Warriors are indeed real, very real, and in the rightful spot and up the near the top in your tiers for championship contention?
Hey, are you believing yet? Are you believing yet, KOC? We did it.
My
a couple
belief
weeks
is
ago.
Increasing. It's increasing.
Have I sold you yet that they believe they truly belong in the top tier title contenders? You're not there
they're
yet.
They're 19-2 with Jimmy. They're not on the same level as OKC. They're not on the same level as Boston yet.
They're 19-2 with those three guys on the floor. And also, when you look at the fact that they were targeting Luka Doncic defensively, just as much as the Lakers were targeting Steph defensively, but who was making up for it on the offensive end? It was Steph Curry. He was making plays continually down the stretch, getting to the free throw line. And I think it's imperative that we mention that Steph Curry getting to the rim, drawing fouls, is another layer that Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green, Bajemski now shooting 40% over his last 20 games. In the first 20 games of the season, Bajemski was shooting 20%. So he's doubled his shooting percentage from, it looked like he was totally lost to start the year. And Steph Curry is opening up the game for his teammates, and they're doing so much better now as of late with Jimmy Butler. But the through line in all of it is Steph Curry. And the way that they're playing right now, I put them at the top tier. Draymond Green locked in, Jimmy Butler locked in, and the role players. Look, we got Kuminga. He's back, and he's playing at a high level. I just feel like a Golden State Warriors are in that top tier. I still have OKC as my favorite, but I still believe top five or in that top tier, the five contenders.
I mean, look, the one thing I will say about Golden State is, as you said, with Butler, the way he's gelled with Draymond and with Steph, defensively, the layer he adds as well, even when he has an off night, the fact they can switch everything defensively against Luka, they were tremendous, Tom. I mean, they made life hard on Luka. I don't think Luka brought it. He was off from the start of the game. But ultimately, Golden State's defense is one of the reasons to also be bullish on them. Let's move on to my first one here of our 10 important things, 10 storylines in the final 10 days of the regular season. The Celtics are peaking, but will the Bucks, the Cavs, the Knicks, these other top teams in the East, will they fix themselves? Because you get the Celtics peaking. Kristaps Porzingis, ever since he returned to injury, averaging 22 points, 8 boards, 3 assists, 2 blocks a game. He's making 41% of his threes, dominating every spot on the floor, post-ups, pick and pops, attacking closeouts. Doesn't matter. The Celtics are 7-0 in those games he's played ever since he returned. They have a plus 20 net rating when he's on the floor in those games as well. Meanwhile, Knicks are still without Brunson. He's supposed to return this week, but how will he look? The Bucks without Dame, with the blood clot issue he had, he might return. And you have Giannis, who just had a 35-point, 20-assist, 17-board game. Absolutely unbelievable on Thursday night. But that's against Philly. They need Dame against these playoff-level opponents. And Giannis is looking like he's ready to peak, but will the team be there with him? And then you have the Cavs, 5-5 in their last 10 games. We've talked about their recent struggles a lot on this podcast. They're 2-0 in their last two games, Clippers and Knicks. Those are better wins. But right now, Boston is beginning to peak, Tom. And it feels like some of these other teams are starting to slide. So over the final 10 days, that's one of the things I'm going to be watching heading into the postseason. Can these other teams fix themselves to be a true challenger to the defending champions?
Yeah, Boston, it's kind of hard to tell whether they're like coasting through the regular season or whether they're resting their guys and KP just to like put them in a bubble before we get into the postseason. And then they, you know, kick it up a notch. With the Cavs, I feel like they have another level to get to. And I'll explain why. Interestingly enough, they started DeAndre Hunter in the starting lineup when they acquired him at the deadline for Caris LeVert. And then they completely abandoned that lineup. Like they go to it sometimes later in the game where they'll have DeAndre Hunter in that Max Strus spot or that Isaac Okoro spot. And look at the numbers here. 8 games with DeAndre Hunter playing with the other core four, the Cleveland Cavaliers, their net rating with that lineup, that 5-man lineup, is plus 44 every 100 possessions. And they're not going to it to start the game, presumably because they want to kind of stagger DeAndre Hunter and maybe go small with Hunter at the four and Evan Mobley at the five. But I kind of feel like this is one of those like sleeper stories that if they go to DeAndre Hunter at their fifth slot in that starting lineup, this might be a totally different team. And we haven't seen it much, but I kind of feel like they have that little ace in the hole.
And I'm hoping we see some of that over the final 10 games here. I want the Cavs to get right. I want to have a Boston-Cleveland Eastern Conference Finals down the line. Obviously, by late May, you could see Cleveland fix themselves. But I hope we see it before the end of the regular season. Okay, Tom, what do you have next?
I've got the Grizzlies going all in for better or for worse with Ja Morant. And we saw after the NBA had issued a warning to Ja Morant for the gun gestures, he did it again in the opening minutes of that game. And Ja Morant, you know what? Still delivering. He has been the focal point of this offense ever since Isolo took over for Taylor Jenkins. And he has continued to hit threes at a high rate, well beyond what he normally does, coming into this stretch under 30% from downtown, hits the game winner. And you know what? Like, if he continues to shoot this well, this is a game changer for Ja Morant and the Memphis Grizzlies. I'm not believing this 3-point shot where he's hit 8 of 15 over his last two games, and this is a 30% shooter for his career from downtown. And if he's able to hit this at a higher rate, he levels up as a point guard. They're giving him the rock. They're making him create. They're upping the pick and roll attacks. We talked about it with Dan Devine earlier this week on the Big Number podcast. Is like they're going all in with Ja Morant and increasing his pick and roll attacks. Question for me is this sustainable? The three-point shooting and his health. He's been healthy over the last few games, but Ja Morant has missed 30 games this season. One of the big reasons why Memphis Grizzlies, the whole firing of Taylor Jenkins didn't make any sense for me is that they were overachieving this year. Like by all metrics, they were a top six net rating, and Ja Morant is now being like asked to be the focal point, running a lot more Zach Edey pick and rolls. But to me, I just think that this is a little bit of smoke and mirrors recently, and I'm curious to see how they do going forward and what the league does about that gun gesture, because to me, that he is taunting, not just like taunting the opposing bench or taunting his father on the sidelines. Like he is taunting the league office, and I'm very interested to see what the league office, Adam Silver, does now after they're like, dude, we let you off the hook on this one, but we've suspended you twice for gun-related incidents. And now, in the first game back, you're doing the gun gesture again? KOC, I think he's really good, but it seems like he is, I don't know. I just can't see him as a reliable option, as a number one option for a title contender. If this is the way he's going to behave, and I don't buy the three-point shooting.
From a trolling perspective, I can't help but respect it. I can't. It's just funny. I mean, like I also like how they call it finger gun gesture. This is more like a rifle gesture, just the way he's pointing his hands out. Finger guns like boop, 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 like that. It's just, yeah. This is a little different what Ja's doing. But ultimately, with his actions, as you said, Tom, from a player standpoint, from a contention standpoint, yes, it's funny. He's trolling. Fans might like it. But ultimately, it looks immature. And it doesn't look like a guy who should be the leader of a championship team. And that's where you see these actions, despite him having these good performances lately, despite hitting the game-winning buzzer beater last night. I don't feel like you can trust Ja. I don't feel like his actions have shown that all over the years. Even the way the Taylor Jenkins situation was handled this year, not really embracing that system that was installed. And yes, it is very easy to argue that the system did not make sense for the personnel. When you have Ja Morant, a heavy, high pick and roll guy with a team that drafted Zach Edey, a big, bruising screen and roll guy who's also developed the ability to pick and pop, and you cut Ja's pick and rolls in half? In half? I mean, he was near the bottom of the league in the Grizzlies, as you talked about on your show. They're one of these teams that were an outlier with the least amount of screens being run historically. So, look, man, I think Taylor Jenkins, it was in the right to fire him. He lost that locker room. They had to make a change. But ultimately, I'm also not buying Ja's recent play, and I'm also not buying him as a leader of the team. I still think all his actions show he still needs to do a lot of growing up.
Yeah, and look, they got Zach Edey. They got Jaren Jackson Jr. Those are huge bodies out there. Run, pick, and roll. See how it goes, but let's not confuse what's happening here. A lot of teams are going under that pick and roll and daring Ja Morant to take that 3-point shot. And just because he's gotten hot over the last two games, and he hit that game winner against Khalil Ware, driving and attacking, and he got the nice roll. But a lot of times he's got this floater game where he's not going to the rack. And when that floater is working in that kind of like 10 to 15 foot range, he's going to look pretty good, but I just don't think he's efficient enough. I don't believe his 3-point shot. And I think Jaren Jackson Jr. is going to have to carry, and Desmond Bane are going to have to carry him to a lot of wins in the postseason if they're going to go deep. This can't be all about Ja, even though he wants to make a statement.
And they're not going to go deep. I still don't think they're going to make the playoffs. I still look at those other teams in the West right now, and I think they're going to either get beat in the play-in, or if they do make it, they just completely just get destroyed in the first round of the playoffs. And the team they could face in the first round will be the team that I'm watching here next, Oklahoma City. Will the Thunder win 70 games? Because, Tom, right now they're 64-12 with six games to go. So if they win all six, they'll be only the third team in NBA history to win 70 games. Of course, the 95-96 Bulls first did it when they won 72 games. They won the finals. And, of course, the Warriors back in 15-16 won 73 games. up 3-1. They blow that to the Cleveland Cavaliers, but they still were a historic regular season team. And coming up for Oklahoma City, they have a tough schedule. They face the Rockets tonight, Friday. Then they have two games against the Lakers. Then they face the Suns, who, I mean, they feel like they're laying down dead, but who knows? And then they have the Jazz and the Pelicans to close the season.
So it starts off as hard. It starts off as hard.
It starts off hard, and then it gets easier. But, I mean, they got a shot, man. They do have a shot. This team, it doesn't feel like they're letting – they're not going off pedal to the metal here. They're not letting off. They're pedal to the metal right now. So they get a shot.
I think they do it. I think because on court, as long as Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is on the floor, they're going to have an incredible chance to win. That dude is unbelievable, man. Like, I'm going to look this up right now. He is, at this moment, 20-plus scoring in 69 straight games. 69 straight games with at least... Nice. Very nice. 69 with 20-plus. He is a metronome. He is the constant. Shout out to Lost for all the Lost fans out there. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, in my opinion, is the MVP this year. The Oklahoma City Thunder are by far, in my opinion, the best team in the NBA. They have the best point differential in NBA history at the moment. And when you look at what their point differential is lately, it's not even these games aren't even close. So I think when you look at can they beat Houston on Friday night? And then they got that back-to-back set or two-game set with the Lakers. And then it's going to be easy for the rest of the year. I think they do it. And it's a really incredible story. And it's one that I think fans have a hard time wrapping their heads around because we've become so consumed by ring culture that unless they win the championship, we won't be sold by anything they do in the regular season. It's one of the things that bothers me about the regular season in the NBA is that people won't back and celebrate the Oklahoma City Thunder because, hey, who cares if they win 70 games if they don't win a championship? That stuff bothers me because it's like, what are we watching the regular season for if we can't be like wowed by this Thunder team? It's almost like this entire season is a preseason, but we should be really focused. Like what you just said, they have a chance to win 70 games. And I'm not so sure in like national conversations, it's getting what the A block, the B block, the C block, this Thunder team. I talked about it earlier this year. They're historically good. And as long as Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and that core with Chet Holmgren and J-Dub, Alex Caruso, Cason Wallace, those guys are healthy, I don't think anyone's going to beat them.
Yeah, I think they're the favorite in the West for sure. I still think the Celtics are the favorite in the East. And maybe you give the nod to the defending champions that's been there before. But ultimately, Oklahoma City, I had Ben Taylor thinking basketball on the pod last week. And you know the way he talks about their defense, he made a great video about them earlier in the season. Look, man. Lou Dort might win Defensive Player of the Year. I think there's a real chance that people end up voting for him. I'd love to see a straw poll for Defensive Player of the Year. I don't think Draymond should win it. I don't think he was strong enough from start to finish throughout the season. I would favor Evan Mobley over him. I would favor Lou Dort as kind of a representative of that Oklahoma City defense as well, similar to how Marcus Smart won it a few years back for Boston with that great Celtics defense. Oklahoma City is an all-time defense. As we know, they are by far number one in defensive rating. I don't see any reason to believe that won't translate to the postseason. Everybody talks about SGA, you know, oh, he's a grifter. He draws so many fouls. Well, Oklahoma City fouls a lot on defense. Are you going to be calling as many fouls on them defensively when they're allowed to be more aggressive in the postseason as well? Their defense could be even better in the playoffs. And with SGA, he doesn't need to draw a ton of fouls to make a major positive impact. So, I mean, he's my MVP right now. I favor him slightly over Jokic, but it's still very close. But they just have so many different ways of beating you, Tom. They're awesome. And SGA is right now the MVP.
Yeah, for me, he's the MVP. His free throw rate, like his free throws per field goal attempts, is actually down for its second consecutive year. So he's not getting to the free throw line more. He's getting to the free throw line less as a proportion of his overall shot taking. So this idea that he's a free throw merchant or a foul merchant, it's just something that people need to come up with to hate on this dude or criticize him. It's like, that's a skill. Getting to the free throw line is a skill. All the best have done it. And so the idea that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is somehow a lesser player because he gets to the free throw line a lot, it speaks to like, look, man, I think people just don't believe in Shai until he does it in the postseason. Like, we can't believe his regular season is as good as it is unless he goes deep in the previous postseason. We did it to Jokic. We've done it to a lot of great players in the past where until they win a championship, it almost undermines their ability to like gain reputation in the regular season. It's backwards to me. But with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the next thing I want to talk about here is he has the chance to do something that's never been done in the plus-minus era outside of the Warriors. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has a plus 937 plus-minus this season. I'm going to say that again. Plus 937. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is about to join or has a chance to join the exclusive, the VIP club of plus 1,000. Draymond Green, Stephen Curry, the only two players since 1997 when we started tracking officially plus minus in the NBA. No one has ever cracked that 1,000 plateau unless you played for the peak Golden State Warriors in 2016, 2017. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is plus 937 with a handful of games to go. On this pace, if he plays every game, he's going to blow through that. And I just want to point out, the second place guy in the NBA in this category this season, Kev, is plus 561. He is at 937, and the next one is at 561. So Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, we're talking about his MVP candidacy, but this right here, you can't argue that this OKC supporting cast is as good as those Warriors teams, and yet he is in the same realm in terms of winning when he's on the floor.
I mean, that's what this OKC team could be. The Warriors that first won the finals, people had doubts about them after their amazing regular season. And the concern was, well, is this going to translate to the postseason? Are they still too young of a team? Steph is 26 at the time. Klay Thompson's 24. Draymond's still 24. They're all still relatively young, and they hadn't done it in the postseason. But that regular season, the Warriors not only had an emerging star in Steph and an offense that was beginning to be innovative and could beat you so many different ways, they also had an elite defense, and that's where you look at OKC, and they have that as well. And it's part of what makes SGA in that plus 1,000 club. It's not just all scoring. It's not just all offense, Tom. It's the fact they have a great defense, and he also is a great defender as well. There are no weak links on that OKC defense, SGA included at 6'5 with length, great defensive playmaking instincts. That's part of the reason why he's in that club with some of those names, because it's not just offense. It's also D.
Can I just say something real quick? He has more blocks this season than Giannis, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Okay, that's he's second in the NBA in steals, and he has 75 blocks. He has almost twice as many blocks as Nikola Jokic. He has more blocks than Giannis Antetokounmpo. So, like, this dude, it's not – we keep focusing on the foul merch and stuff. He does so much on the basketball court that deserves our praise. He is so good at handling the ball and protecting the ball and limiting turnovers while creating turnovers on the other end. He is the head of the snake. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he is the most complete star player in the league right now. And Jokic, amazing offensive player, but not a great rim protector for a team that desperately needs it. And so I think when it comes to the slim margins, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander checks more boxes than Nikola Jokic, in my opinion.
Quick reminder to people watching us live, give us a thumbs up if you're watching on YouTube. Give us a like if you're watching over on X. Really does help out the show. Tom, coming up next, I have this one. Houston. Where will their first round pick via the Suns, where is it going to end up here? Because you look at the standings right now, the Suns are only a game and a half ahead of the Blazers for the ninth best lottery odds. And they look like they are laying down dead, don't want to be there in the playoffs at all. That ninth spot has a 20.3% chance of moving into the top four, which would mean the Rockets, the 50-win Rockets, the two-seed Rockets, who own the Suns' pick, could have a strong chance of moving into the top four. But the Suns are still only a game back from the Kings for the 10th seed, a chance in the play-in. You got Bradley Beal saying earlier this week to the Arizona Republic, we still believe we can make a run with the talent we have in this locker room. So they've lost a number of games in a row. They look like they are absolutely dead. I know they're not going to make any noise in the playoffs, but you have the Rockets building this thing out, and they have an opportunity here to get good odds because of the Suns. And if you look at that range where the Suns are right now, currently they're in the 11th best odds for the 12th best odds right now. 12, 13, and 14 have never moved up into the top four ever since the odds were flattened in 2019. But in 2019, the Lakers had the 11th best odds. They moved up to number four, got DeAndre Hunter, who was part of the Anthony Davis trade. In 2024, last year, the Spurs had the 11th best odds. They moved up to number four, got Stephon Castle. We've seen teams move up from nine. OKC did it when they got Chet Holmgren in 2022. So that 9, 10, 11 best odds spot, that could be an opportunity for the Rockets to get another special talent or another special asset to use in trades here. So that's something I'm watching over the final stretch here. Where do the Suns end up, not just for KD trades in the future, but for the Rockets?
Yeah. What about KD and that pick? Like, swap, if the Houston Rockets with Ime Udoka, they have a close relationship, Kevin Durant, if they have that pick, and it's top four, I mean, you got Reed Shepherd, our boy Reed Shepherd, still on the Houston Rockets roster, and I think he has a high ceiling. The Houston Rockets are going to have a lot of ability to go get a big fish or a big game hunting this offseason in order to get an A1 superstar on their team. Love Şengün, love Amen Thompson, love Fred VanVleet, love what they're doing. But if they want to win a championship, I think they need to get one of those guys. And if the Phoenix Suns hit that reset button, I think the Houston Rockets have all the assets that they would want. If you're going to trade Kevin Durant, you look at Houston, they've got a lot of pieces, and you talk about, you know, kind of under the radar guys coming off the bench at Kentucky Wildcats. Devin Booker was kind of the banner of that for Phoenix Suns. Why not Reed Shepherd?
You know, I mean, it's going to be interesting here to see what the Suns actually end up doing, because let's move to some mailbag questions to frame our KD conversation here. You guys submitted a bunch of mailbag questions over on X. You can feel free to reply on YouTube or in the chat right now if you'd like to. Just send us some questions, we'll answer live at the end. But here are some that you sent ahead of time. From Segel, he asked, who's winning the war for KD? And that's because earlier this week, Shams Charania reported that Minnesota, New York, Houston, San Antonio, and Miami were the teams that seemed to have mutual interest with Kevin Durant. KD would like to go there, and they would like to get KD. Now, of those teams, Minnesota is intriguing because they don't have the assets necessarily, but KD could try to leverage his way there, and they have players they could give in a trade. Like, you would have to give a Jaden McDaniels. Maybe you give a Naz Reid, somebody like that. And that could appeal to the Suns if they want to keep trying to win games. And with the Rockets, Tom, obviously, like, they have a bunch of Phoenix picks. That's why we're talking about, like, mm-hmm. what does this end of the season mean for the Rockets with the Suns' standings? I've heard the Suns don't want their own picks back. That's what I've continuously heard over the past year, even before this horrible season, that they don't want their own picks back. They want to continue competing, and they want to have picks from other teams. Now, they could just be putting that out there over and over and over and over again to make everybody in the NBA world believe that they don't want their own picks back when that's actually what they do want back. That's possible, that this is just them trying to build leverage for themselves. But it seems genuine from what I've heard with my conversations that this is why they've traded the picks away so willy-nilly. And this is why they've done this with pick swap after pick swap, that they just want other teams' picks. And I think they believe that the three-for-one deal they made with their future 31 first-round pick, and they traded for three worst picks, I think they believe they can do that again when it comes to their 33 pick, when they can trade that. So my understanding is that Phoenix doesn't want their own picks back from Houston, which would really hurt the chances Houston would have of ever getting Kevin Durant.
If they don't want their picks back because for some reason this is the ego of Matt Ishbia and the new ownership that wants to come in there and double down on this failed investment and failed new regime of this KD, Bradley Beal, and Devin Booker trio, and just selling off all their assets and cornering themselves for the future in a CBA that is daring the Phoenix Suns to go all in on this unit. And they've completely, if they have a $500 million payroll and they miss the play-in, Matt Ishbia should sell the team. If you have that fiscal irresponsibility with your organization, you cycle through head coaches and you get Kevin Durant and Devin Booker on the same team. We saw what they did at Team USA, and you get the no trade clause because, hey, the guy who's the CEO that you hired for your team, Josh Bartlestein, the agent for Bradley Beal, is Josh Bartlestein's father. You bring in Bradley Beal, it completely fails. And if you have a $500 million payroll and you've totally ruined your flexibility because of the CBA, like, what are you doing? So go do a reset, swallow your ego, and realize I'm not going to come in here and turn into a title contender overnight. The quote was from Matt Ishbia before the season about trading Kevin Durant and all this stuff was, hey, 29 other GMs would rather be in our position than theirs. And that is just
great
insane.
Quote.
That's
great quote.
It's peak new ownership syndrome. And I do believe that I think this is posturing. What you're describing is that they want to hold on and not trade for their picks back. I think it's posturing. They're trying to build leverage. And at the end of the day, we'll see. But this is such a bizarre situation that we're having like trade talks. Who's going to win the war for KD when the season's still going on? The trade deadline is done and he hasn't made a trade demand. This is where we're at in the NBA.
Yeah, the real intriguing one will be Booker because, you know, he says he wants to be, you know, committed to the Suns for his entire career. It sounds like he will not demand a trade, but will the Phoenix Suns front office get a deal so good that they decide to trade him anyway? Next question from Lou. What is Amen Thompson's ceiling? Tom, I feel like all NBA is the easier answer here for Amen Thompson. To me, it's more of a question of, is he a second-team All-NBA guy, a third-team All-NBA guy? I'll say second-team All-NBA is Amen Thompson's ceiling. That's where I feel comfortable with answering that question from Lou.
Yeah, I think he's 22 years old. So, like, we don't really know what he could be. I mean, I think Kawhi. I called him Flubber Kawhi earlier is because he's just... This season,
so you're talking top five then. You think first team All NBA, top five in the league then potentially at his peak.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. His movement patterns, the way he moves around the floor, the defensive first mentality. He's been having triple doubles this season, leading the offense in a pinch at 22 years old. This guy, I mean, I'm not saying he has a limitless ceiling, but I certainly think that he's first team All-NBA ceiling. I mean, when you're talking about how much he's improved since the first game that he suited up for the Rockets to now, that exponential curve for him, it's scary to think what Asar and him can be in the NBA when they're this young, this good. Amen Thompson, I think he has a better case for DPOY than a lot of players that are in that conversation. I personally think that he might be the favorite in my book the Houston Rockets are top four in defensive rating, better than the Cavs, better than the Warriors. And you're telling me that this dude with his block rate, his steal rate, the ability to guard the opposing best player, like this guy is a rim protector and a menace defensively. He checks off more boxes than Draymond or Evan Mobley in my book.
Yeah, I mean, I think defensive player of the year is a fair argument. Next, Kawhi, I don't think so. I mean, I just don't see the shooting ability.
Ceiling. Like everything goes right for him.
Yes, sure. Yeah. That he figures out the jumper, that the jumper gets figured out over the course of time. I don't see the ceiling that high with his jumper. That's where my I'm limiting him to second team all NBA, which, oh boy, that's not the worst thing in the world to be one of the 10 best guys in the NBA. Next question from Growl Towel Central, a great Grizzlies account over on X. He asks, what's the best and worst Cooper Flagg fit? Tom, start us off here.
Is there a worst fit? What are we talking about here? That Kev, does he have a bad fit anywhere? He's so versatile so well-rounded. Where would Cooper Flagg?
I mean, there's a best and worst of everything. Like if you're there always is. And I think for Cooper, like do you want to have to try to fit alongside Zion and deal with potential injuries moving forward? To me, that would be the worst fit if I'm Cooper Flagg. It's the on-court fit with Zion, like cuz Cooper's shot would have to sustain. The way he shot over 40% from three, well over 80% from the line ever since he turned 18 this year at Duke back in December, the shot needs to continue being elite if you're paired with Zion. Whereas with these other teams, you could settle in at a 34, 35% guy from three, not quite elite, but solid, and it can be okay. So that's where I think there are some fits where it's like, okay, he can work anywhere. He's going to help any franchise. Cooper Flagg is absolutely incredible. I think you're right about that. But if you're him and you're ranking all the lottery teams with where you want to go, yeah, I do think there's a worse fit.
Okay, fair enough. I think with Zion, like, it would be Cooper Flagg's franchise. Zion would be, I think, either moved or they would consider Cooper Flagg, hand him the keys to run that franchise. So I'm less concerned about like the quote unquote fit with Zion Williamson. Don't know if he's going to be healthy enough to have that problem. And I would also say OKC is the answer to this question. Who is the best fit for Cooper Flagg? The way that they have this player development path and the leadership skills, the front office top down.
How? Like we're talking like a mega trade?
I mean, they have the ability to trade up in order to, they can consolidate some first round picks in order to get into the lottery. And they control
Philly ends up at seven and they use that pick with a bunch of other future picks to make, you can't say no to this offer for number one. That's the scenario we're talking about here with OKC is the best fit.
I mean, I don't know how they're going to pull this off. It's just, all right, so if they get the number one pick, obviously OKC
if they get number one, like it's just like Adam Silver, say no. Say no.
I think in my head I got them mixed up with the Spurs, who have Atlanta's pick and their own pick, and so they can leap up to get number one. The Spurs franchise, like since in these last like 5 years with Greg Popovich, they haven't hit a home run on every move, but I would say if Cooper Flagg is next to Victor Wembanyama, De'Aaron Fox, and Steph Castle, that would be the best situation for Cooper Flagg. Yeah. And I would hope that Victor Wembanyama's DVT, we never have to talk about that ever again. That would be the best fit for Cooper Flagg. And they'll figure out the coaching thing going forward. But this, to me, with Victor Wembanyama, that's the answer. Like, he solves all of the problems. No problem with fit. If you got Cooper Flagg and Victor Wembanyama as your back line, like, that is Tim Duncan, D-Rob 2.0.
Yeah, so I think Spurs are the best fit for sure because, Victor will be the best player on the team. And if Cooper's your second best player with Victor Wembanyama, you're contending every single year in the years to come. A last mailbag question here from Diesel. He asked, what is the plan for Philly if their luck goes to OKC? Philly, of course, has a top six protected first round draft pick. Right now, they have the fifth best odds to move up into the top four, but they could lose it. They could go to Oklahoma City. I think the answer is pretty easy. You just fold the franchise, Tom. That's what you do. You fold the franchise.
That's amazing. Just give up. Give up. The Joel Embiid that he had a scope, like something is off here. The fact that he shut down the season like a month ago, and then after all of this deliberation, they decided to go in for a scope, which is like a minor procedure, which seems to suggest like it wasn't all that bad when they went in to look at what is going on with his knee and all of the 20 second opinions that they've gotten. I don't know. It's the reporting around Joel Embiid's knee issues have been so shrouded in mystery over the last couple of years. And the way that they've reported this out, or at least the way that this has happened, it makes me wonder, like, what is actually happening? Because a scope after such all the pain that he was having and all this dire circumstances around his knee situation, and then to have like a minor thing where he's only out a month, I don't understand it. And then they just shut down Tyrese Maxey. They just shut down Paul George. They've got Quentin Grimes and a nice story in Jared McCain, who was in the lead for Rookie of the Year. But I don't see them hitting the reset button. Like, you're saying fold the franchise, like partly in jest.
I'm kidding.
But like in that same vein, are you suggesting that they should just blow it all up and sell off for whatever you can with Joel Embiid and Paul George and just start around Tyrese Maxey?
I don't think you can. I think even if you put Embiid on the block, let's just say you did, what are you actually going to get? What are you actually going to get for Embiid with the amount of years and money he has left on his contract with his current injury situation and the uncertainty about his current status? So no, I don't think you can trade Embiid. I think if you're Philadelphia, you just have to continue trying to build. You just got to continue trying to build a franchise as you intended this year that can contend for a championship. You hope Embiid can stay healthy for a year or at least into the playoffs, and that McCain keeps getting better, Maxey keeps getting better, that Paul George returns to the guy that you thought you were getting when you signed him to that max deal last summer. So no, I think you just got to keep building and take your lumps and try to use your other existing first round picks in the future. With that said, let's return to our 10 important things here for the final 10 days of the regular season, because the tanking standings are one of those very, very important things right now. And it's very tight at the top. If you look at the lottery standings right now, Washington, they still have a shot to catch Utah for the top odds. Charlotte, probably going to stay in that three spot, I would expect, but they're only a little bit up on New Orleans, and Philly's only a little bit back from Philly's only a little bit back from New Orleans for the fourth best odds, which would dramatically increase their chances of keeping their pick. Philly, 42.1% chance right now of moving up to the top four. That would increase to 48.1% if they move up to the fourth spot. So very important here. And I expect we're going to see some of these teams trying to lose some games hard over the remainder of the season, Tom.
Yeah, the quiet quitting we've seen from Toronto, where Scotty Barnes has started 16 games but only finished two of them in the last, you know, month or so.
How amazing is that? Isn't that incredible?
When Ochai Agbaji needs rest days, Jakob Poeltl needs rest days, DNP rest. They're DNP resting multiple players in a lost season, which is just classic. But they're not even the worst in this category. You got the Utah Jazz, who had Walker Kessler have 8 3-pointers in a game. I'm kind of disappointed, honestly, that he hasn't been continuing to launch 8 threes a game. It's been like kind of muted recently. But
do you think Adam Silver in the league office gave the Jazz a little slap on the wrist, like, hey, you can't let this guy shoot so many threes?
I don't know what he can offer, though. Like, if they don't do it. Like, there's nothing the league can really do once the players play. It's not like that Adam Silver wants to get in the business of like coaching for Will Hardy. So it's, I don't know what they could have done to bully Utah Jazz into not letting Walker Kessler shoot 8 threes a game. But it brings me to my next thing that I'm going to be watching. You brought up the tanking. The Mark Madsen Award for the most egregious tanking effort. Mark Madsen, for those kids who don't understand what I'm referring to, Mad Dog. Mark Madsen was playing for the Minnesota Timberwolves with KG in a season where I think they started 12-6, and then things went sideways, and they decided to tank to keep their top 10 pick in 2006. In the season finale, Mark Madsen, the center, who hadn't taken a three-pointer in his previous 135 games, took 7 3-pointers in overtime. He had a double overtime game against the Memphis Grizzlies. They had to lose it to keep the pick. So what did they do? They just ran ISOs. They ran plays every time down the floor for Mark Madsen to shoot threes. And he took 0-for-7 three-pointers in the overtime periods. It was a double overtime game. It was egregious. It was insane. And in the game, Mark Madsen was 1-for-15. And you flash forward. They got their pick. Kevin, do you know who they got with their lottery pick that year? It was Brandon Roy, and they traded him away for Randy Foy. So think about this. They traded Brandon Roy to the Portland Trail Blazers, and then they got Randy Foy. There was this whole like thing about the Blazers leaping in to take Randy Foy and forcing the trade, because I guess there was this whole like deal that they already had pre-agreed upon. So you draft Brandon Roy with that new pick that Mark Madsen helped you get, and you end up trading him to the Portland Trail Blazers for Randy Foy, of all people. This is going to be interesting. Who is going to be the Mark Madsen? What are we going to see down the stretch? The egregious tanking. I can't wait. Walker Kessler's in the lead right now with 8 3-pointers from a center who does not shoot threes. I'm curious, KOC, what we're going to see down the stretch, because those ping pong balls are extremely valuable with Cooper Flagg every game that he plays.
Well, I mean, with Walker Kessler, I'm sure he would say, hey, I shot threes in high school. but you didn't shoot threes well in high school, which is why you haven't really been shooting them since then. I think a similar one could be, and maybe we'll see this from Philly, considering the urgency with their pick, they bench Quentin Grimes and they let Adembona, their center, run the show. That would be Madsen-esque if Bona is out there running the Sixers offense with Grimes benched.
Yo, Giannis had what? An unprecedented stat line with 20 assists, like 35 points and, you know, double digit rebounds against a Philadelphia 76ers team that is trying to lose, trying to keep that pick. I feel like we need an asterisk on some of these stat lines against these tanking teams. In the season finale, we'll talk about it in a little bit, but the season finale, we've got some epic matchups, and one of them is a lot of those matchups. It's going to be a Mark Madsen redux. I'm really excited for it.
Next up, I have, do the Minnesota Timberwolves keep it rolling? I sent out a tweet the other day about the Wolves and said, well, they have an easy schedule remaining. They should win all of their remaining games, and they feel like a safe bet to be a top six seed in the Western Conference. Right now, they are currently tied with the Memphis Grizzlies for the sixth seed. They currently, Memphis has the tiebreaker over them, but Memphis trending down, Minnesota trending up. And I get a ton of replies from Timberwolves fans like, you don't know our team. We always lose to the teams that we should beat. And that's true. They have a lot this season. But I feel like Minnesota, over this past month or so, is just different. I feel like they are a new team right now, that they have found themselves. They feel like with the balance they have offensively, Randall running a little bit more point, fitting in well, Gobert back to his defensive player of the year levels on that end of the floor. He has been absolutely dominant on defense and on the boards. He looks totally healthy for them. Minnesota feels like they're beginning to click. And so you have clarity now with ownership. Glenn Taylor's not going to be appealing to Minnesota arbitrators. Mark Laurie and A-Rod, they officially own the Minnesota Timberwolves. You get clarity there. And it seems like Finch starts to have some clarity with that playoff rotation as well. And their amazing double overtime win they had against the Nuggets earlier this week, Naz Reid is suspended because of the brawl, of the scuffle, whatever you want to call it. DiVincenzo also suspended. So they basically played only six guys in that game: Edwards, Gobert, Randall, McDaniels, Conley, and Nikhil Alexander-Walker. They all played over 36 minutes in that double OT game. Add Naz Reid and DiVincenzo to that, you got like a really freaking strong eight-man rotation, Tom. Really strong. So of those current play-in teams, to me, Minnesota is the biggest threat to upset their way to a deep run. But I don't think they're going to end up in the play-in. I think they're going to move up to six or higher, and we're going to see them in a first-round guaranteed playoff matchup. And they're a threat, man, the way they're playing right now. They are a threat to make a little bit of a run here.
So this is where I bring up how OKC gets the number one overall pick. Okay, Minnesota gets that top six. Okay, the Warriors get the top six as well. That pushes Memphis, and it pushes the Clippers into the play-in. The Clippers are sending their pick to OKC this year. So if we see a scenario in which the Clippers lose out of the play-in and they end up in the lottery, then that is a lottery pick for OKC. So I'm just putting it out there that as good as the Minnesota Timberwolves have played and as good as the Clippers have played, there is still a possibility that the Oklahoma City Thunder, not a slim possibility, a real chance that OKC ends up with a lottery pick via the Los Angeles Clippers in that Paul George deal. So if Minnesota can get in that top six along with the Warriors, that means that Ja Morant is going to be in the play-in, that the Clippers are going to be in the play-in, and the Clippers are playing Dallas twice here, and this is going to be a huge shift in their odds in terms of trying to make it into that top six with Anthony Davis back and playing well. This whole like logjam between the Warriors, the Minnesota Timberwolves, the Memphis Grizzlies, and the Clippers, it's going to change. And they're going to be jockeying for a position over the next couple of weeks. It's going to be really, really fun to watch. And that is one of these teams is going to be out of the playoffs. Memphis with their coaching change 9 games before the end of the regular season. The Clippers with Kawhi and James Harden and Zoo playing great basketball. And Anthony Edwards. There's going to be a team left out in the cold that is going to be a lottery team. And I would suspect that the Kevin Durant sweepstakes gets even hotter if, say, the Clippers or the Timberwolves or the Memphis Grizzlies, they end up out of the playoffs entirely, and they're going to be looking at a situation where they need to make a big swing to kind of fix whatever problems they have. And that's what's at stake here in the next 10 days of the regular season. I think the KD stuff is going to get in a really heightened, dialed up, because one of these teams is going to be disappointed.
Yeah, because the Suns are, and odds are, they're going to miss the play-in entirely. Their schedule is ridiculously tough. They have, I think, the opponent win percentage is, 63. Like, they don't have a single easy game remaining this season. So for Phoenix, I don't think they're going to make it. But Minnesota, I feel confident they're going to make that top six, one of those top six spots in the Western Conference. So we have 9 so far, Tom, for our final 10 days of the regular season. What do you have for us last year?
All right, we got the White Lotus season 3 season finale coming up. I've been a little disappointed with the show, by the way. It's not going anywhere.
It's still fun.
I'm a Wake Forest grad, and this whole Duke thing, like the guy, the dad who just continually is like sleepwalking his way through the season, spoiler, I'm tired of it. Like, let's move the plot along a little bit. And everything that we've been building towards, usually the penultimate episode is like the great episode where everything goes nuts, and it was just kind of meh. But anyway, I'm going to be watching the season finale,
It's still a fun show, Tom, but it's still really fun. But this season has moved slower than all of the others. That's the issue with it. Too slow. Yeah. Not enough movement. Yeah. But I'm still having a good time. I'm still laughing. I still like the characters. I just want things to move forward. And I don't know how they're going to resolve it all in one episode on Sunday night. I just don't know how they're going to do that in one night.
Apparently, Patrick Schwarzenegger, he knows ball. Like, he's a big NBA fan. We got to make this happen.
He's a tremendous actor. A non-spoiler comment here. When the thing happens, and he goes from cocky and confident to in a state of shock, unbelievable acting. And by the way, yeah. Schwarzenegger, his Netflix documentary, Arnold, on Netflix, 3-part, like, hour-long episodes. The Arnold doc on Netflix is awesome. It is sensational. He is such an amazing character and human being. It was just fascinating. It's not perfect, a flawed person, but I don't know. The Arnold doc was incredible. That's all. Anyway, Tom, back to NBA.
Season finale talk. Okay, I'm looking forward to White Lotus this Sunday, but I'm also looking forward. I've already circled it on the calendar a bunch of times. April 13th. That is the season finale, the regular season finale for the 82-game season. Every team is playing. This is one of the best things that the NBA has done, is that they've basically got every team playing at the same exact time. And we've got 15 games with everybody playing, and some of these are going to dictate the playoffs, the lottery situation. It's going to be awesome. It is going to be the playoffs before the playoffs, before the play-in. Look at these matchups. We've got 15 games on April 13th. It's a Sunday. The first one tips off. The first set of games tips off at 1. We've got Orlando, Atlanta, Charlotte, Boston, New York, Brooklyn, Indiana, Cleveland, Washington, Miami, Detroit, Milwaukee, Chicago, and Philly. Then in the second set, we got Clippers, Warriors, Nuggets, Rockets, Mavericks, Grizzlies, Jazz, Timberwolves, Thunder, Pelicans, Lakers, Blazers, Suns, Kings, Raptors, Spurs. I mean, I don't know which one I'm most excited for, but I've got a few that I've kind of circled here. The Clippers and the Warriors potentially deciding who locks in a top six seed and who goes into the play-in. Orlando at Atlanta to decide who's going to host. That first play-in game is going to be very interesting. Detroit at Milwaukee to decide who's in the 5 seed or the 6 seed. And then, of course, we're going to see if Phoenix can hold on. But Phoenix at Sacramento could decide who is going to get in that play-in tournament and who is not. I don't even know if the teams are going to want to get into the play-in or they're just going to wave the white flag. But there's so many. Think about this. I don't know if you have a particular game that you're most excited in for either tanking reasons or for just like competitive reasons, but we've got the potential for Oklahoma City Thunder playing against the New Orleans Pelicans, where they've already shut down half the roster. And then the Wizards, I think the Wizards are playing against the Miami Heat in that one. There's going to be lots of tanking Mark Madsen scenarios, and I'm excited for the season finale. April 13th, everybody.
Yeah, I hope White Lotus is able to be as good as that final day of the NBA regular season will, because it has a chance to be unbelievable. Has a chance. Some of those games might matter less than they appear they could on paper. Like you said, Kings, Suns, that could be unbelievable, but it might not be. So we'll see how the standings shake out over the next 9 days leading up to that 10th day. But to close out today's episode of the KOC show, we're going to take some more mailbag questions. Submit a question in the YouTube chat or send us a tweet on X, and we'll respond to that there. But let's start off with some you guys sent ahead of time, starting off with one related to a topic earlier from at Thunder Z. Who's the biggest threat to knock off the Thunder in the West, Tom? Who do you think it is? Number one threat to OKC? Golden State, right? That's your answer, I'm sure.
I think it's Golden answer State. For you. Yeah, it's Golden State. Okay. The three-point shooting, they've already won the matchup in the season series, Golden State. And I think with the championship pedigree, you got Jimmy Butler, who's been to the finals twice, and you have nobody on the Thunder outside of Alex Caruso, who's been gone the distance. That, to me, with the three-point shooting, with the ability to get hot, and OKC's Achilles heel, if they have one, is if they can get enough shooting on their side to out-duel the opponent and their three-point shooting, because their rim protection and Chet Holmgren walling off the paint and Isaiah Hartenstein and then a bunch of wings who play like bigs and the way they take charges in the paint, it's going to be a team that wins from the outside. And what if Steph Curry and Draymond Green go in there and just feel like, you know what? We've been here before. We've been in the trenches. And OKC, I feel like, would win that series still, but it's going seven. It's going deep. And I think they have the biggest threat against that Oklahoma City Thunder team.
Do you think there's any chance it's Minnesota with their length and size? Yeah. Any chance?
I think so. Man, Anthony Edwards, I love watching him play. If he can deal with the doubles and if he can deal with the size, and play with that kind of confidence and not like kind of give in to the doubles and just pass out and attack some of them, I think he has a real shot to be the best player in that series, but I still got OKC in six.
Ronnie Miller in the YouTube chat asked, rank the NBA ceilings of Ace Bealey, Kaman Malawat, Vijay Edgecombe, Jeremiah Fears, and Derek Queen. So you can see my NBA draft big board over on our NBA draft guide at Yahoo Sports. I think of those, you know, non-Cooper guys, I have Ace Bealey currently three on my board. I'm not totally locked into keeping him there because I don't completely trust the scoring. Everybody compares him to Michael Porter Jr. But Tom, like, you watch Ace Bealey, the efficiency is just not there on the level of an MPJ. But I'd still keep him number three because of his size and because of his playmaking ability. Malawat, if he adds a three, maybe the ceiling is even higher than Ace Bealey. So I think the order you have there, Ronnie, is pretty close. I'd move Derek Queen ahead of Edgecombe, and I'd keep the Edgecombe and Fears as the guys last on the list. So I think Bailey, Malawat, Queen, Edgecombe, Fears would be the ceilings for those top five guys you listed there, Ronnie. Any thoughts on any of those five, Tom, from what you watched in March Madness?
I love Malawat. I love the way he plays. I think he's just going to tap into his potential. I think he's huge, obviously, but he's much more skilled than I think people give him credit for. And so I think he's legit. Now, that's the guy that, I mean, I've seen him in person, so I might be biased, but I think he is the best prospect of that group.
Yeah, and he hasn't played a lot of basketball. He started late, and he's improved over the course of the season for Duke. And, you know, the floor is there. Defensive versatility, altering shots around the basket. He shoots over 80% at the rim because he's a lob finisher. And the touch, he has like right-handed and left-handed hook shots. He's 76-77% from the free throw line. And he has good touch, man. And Gavoni from ESPN posted a video of him taking step-back threes in pregame. There's something there, man. There's something there with Malawat to be more than just a rim finisher, rim protector. So next question here from Gal Katz over on X. He asked, this is a question for you, Tom. What do you think Denny Avdia's ceiling is?
Baby Giannis. I'm not saying he's Giannis. Baby Giannis. But a smaller, maybe not the rim protector, defensive player of the year as Giannis was. But I do think that Denny has the same kind of barrel down the floor, instant, get a rebound, instant fast break. He's already top seven in the NBA in and ones. He's second in the NBA in and ones, a category that Giannis dominates. Denny Avdija, at 24 years old, is second in the NBA since February 1st in and ones. He's averaging 24 points, 10 rebounds, and 5.5 assists over his last 14 games. No Blazer in their entire franchise history has ever hit those marks in a 14-game sample. This dude is really good, and I think he's got some levels to get up higher, his turnovers, but it's the same kind of game. When you watch Denny, he looks a lot like a smaller Giannis out there, and that doesn't mean he's going to be an MVP, but I think he's going to be an all-NBA ceiling all-star next year. I think I said this on the Big Number last in the last episode. First-time all-stars next year. I've got Denny Avdija, I've got Austin Reeves, and I've got Chet Holmgren. I think those three guys are going to be in the All-Star game next year, and I do think that Denny Avdija deserves it. He is a sensational player, really fun to watch.
I agree. I mean, Denny does look like a Giannis light, baby Giannis type of guy. The way Portland uses him in their offense and just the way his skills translate as well, as a bigger guy with some ball skills, playmaking skill, and the ability to drive downhill with not just pure force, like Giannis can do that, but also with some skill with a handle, as Giannis can as well. So I'm with you, Denny. And he won't win most improved player of this year because, you know, statistically he's not significantly better than last year, but the eyeball test, like he's way better than last year. And I think he could be a contender for it next year if he carries on the statistical production that we've seen from him in recent months into next season. And speaking of statistical improvements, in the YouTube chat, Gavin asked, what are your thoughts on Paolo now that he seems fully recovered from injury? And I got a ton of comments and replies over on X saying, is Paolo Banchero good now? Is Paolo good now? Are you sure Paolo's good? Like all this stuff, because after the All-Star break, I did a question for the second half of the regular season. And I was like, are we sure Paolo Banchero's good? Because at the time he was super inefficient. He was really struggling defensively, high turnovers. Yes, Paolo Banchero looks absolutely sensational as of late for the Orlando Magic. And that's despite less than ideal circumstances, which is the second thing Gavin mentioned in his comment. He said, where would he and the Magic be with all the injuries? Well, they'd be in a much better spot, that's for damn sure, if they had all of their guys around Paolo, more shooting around him as well, because he looks like he's taking a bit of a leap here, Tom. I do, wonder how much of this is small sample size theater with the dramatically improved jump shot percentages we've seen from Paolo as of late, but it feels like watching him, the game is slowing down. It feels like he's developing an understanding for toggling between playmaking and scoring. I feel like there's an improvement there. And, how real are these March games, these late season April games? There's questions there, but I had him ranked number one in his draft class. I have belief in Paolo. And what we've seen as of late kind of helps improve my belief or restore my belief in Paolo with what we've seen lately.
Yeah, to me, though, it's just he's still not super efficient to be like an alpha on a really good team. Even with his resurgent play recently, it's still like his post All-Star break true shooting percentage is at 58%. Before the All-Star break, it was at 51%. So he's made a little bit of a leap, but it's not like he's in that upper echelon of stars in my book. I think he's a fringe All-Star candidate.
Is that because of the fact they have basically zero shooting on their roster, though? Is that why, with Paolo's inefficiencies? And that's where, like, I wonder how much of this is environment, situation versus the player's own deficiencies. Because yes, every player has their limitations, but the Magic have like no shooting at all. And that is something for Banchero. Imagine you plug him onto a team with a bunch of shooters. He'd be way better efficiency-wise, I would think. That's the way I feel mm-hmm. about him, and that's Magic system. But the Magic don't have a lot of shooters. They're last in the NBA in three-point percentage, 25th in attempts. That's their number one priority this summer with their draft picks, with their trades, with free agents. That's what they have to go after, is shooters.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I was so high on Denny Avia is his ability to get, you know, those and ones where he bullies the defense. Well, number one since February 1st in and ones is Paolo Banchero. So he is a bully. And when you have spacing around him, I think he's going to get better. But one reason why they're not good at three-point shooting is Paolo Banchero is not a good three-point shooter, jump shooter. And I do think that that would be another level that he can hit is if he figures that out. Kind of in the same way, like I think I thought he was like Blake Griffin 2.0 coming out of Duke. And Blake Griffin improved his three-point shooting throughout his career. And if he does that, like, yeah, he's going to ascend into that upper echelon. But I want to see him get more more efficient out there. He's going to figure out the distribution. Like, I don't think he's as, geared towards playmaking as some of his other got bigs that are in that upper echelon. But they do need shooting in the worst way. They do. And I do think he'll be better in that new five out. If they have four shooters around him, he's going to look different.
Next question. Best NBA food city? That question is from at the Indy 500. Best NBA food city, Tom. You're a big foodie. You're the food blog.
I'm going to agree with... Yeah. I do this podcast called Pack Your Knives where we recap Top Chef. We're not quite in the season finale era, but I'm doing it with Eric Adjapong, who's an incredible two-time Top Chef. He's a huge Knicks fan. He's a big NBA head. So if you like Top Chef and you're watching this, you got to hit up that Pack Your Knives podcast. I don't have a top five in my head off the dome. I'm agreeing with Zion, New Orleans, just the Cajun cooking, the mix, the melting pot of different cuisine. I love spicy food and I love the variety that you can get in New Orleans. And I have a huge appetite. So I'm probably going to gain a lot of weight every time I go to New Orleans. LA is up there. Portland is up there. I might be biased, but I just went to Portland for a week and ate through the entire town. It is so good. Khan, as I've mentioned here on this program, from Gregory Gourdet over in Portland. You gotta figure out a way to get there, Kev. Do you have a top three? Is it close to what I have with New Orleans, LA, and Portland?
I've only been to New Orleans once, and it was, you know, really good food. I think I had oysters maybe my first time down there over a lunch with Gavoni. And we got a bunch of oysters. It was delicious. I had a po' boy. It was great.
Did you char-grilled or did you did raw oysters?
I don't remember. This was like 17 All-Star game. I think we did a mixture of both, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Gavoni ordered all the oysters. He's a big oyster guy, apparently. But that was, I think, 2017 All-Star. I think, you know, it's such a generic answer. I still think it's L.A. L.A.'s food scene has everything. Everything from everywhere around the world. And it's all high level from everywhere around the world. And I would say, once Vegas is officially an NBA food city, it's got a chance to be number one. Because Vegas, you talk about unbelievable food from everywhere, especially Asian cuisine. Vegas is outstanding. But Vegas has everything. They have Italian. They have American food. They have Asian food. They have amazing Mexican food. Vegas has everything. So Vegas is very underrated as a food city. Everybody talks about, Vegas is all about partying and, you know, getting drunk and all that. I'm not a partier. I haven't even gambled a dollar in Vegas. I go there for the food and for the shows. Sphere or like Absinthe, some of these tent shows with like America's Got Talent style, you know, people, or like NBA halftime style people like Christian and Scooby, you know, the guy with the dog. He's a big NBA fan. He's always does halftime shows. You know that guy, Christian and Scooby?
Yeah.
Like,
is it the Chihuahua?
Like he does some Vegas stuff. Like those types of shows are fun. They're a good time, and never mind Sphere, and the food is amazing in Vegas. So I think LA, Vegas, New York, that's a basic generic answer, but that would be my top three.
Yeah, Chicago, also New York. So that would be my top five. I'm going to go, all right, so I'll go with New Orleans, LA, New York, Chicago, Portland is my top five.
Amit in the chat says he'd go New York, Toronto, LA. Toronto's a good choice as well. I've only been once. Emmy, our producer, says we're disrespecting the New York food scene. New York belongs there. It does belong there.
They're there. And I will say, Toronto, the Top Chef season right now is in Toronto. So Destination Canada is the Top Chef season. So they, and Gail Simmons from Toronto, She's the host of the season, pretty much. It's a home game for her. It's Tom Colicchio, by the way, huge UNC Tar Heel fan. I know who he's rooting for in this Final Four, and it's not Duke. I can promise you that.
Last question here. This is a very fun one. It's from Steven. Steven asked, would you rather be in a steel cage match with Steven Adams, James Johnson, or Kenyon Martin?
The answer is not James Johnson.
No, I agree. Not James Johnson. That's for sure. Not James Johnson, 100%. To me, I think I'd rather be in the steel cage match against Steven Adams. I would feel like there's a slim chance he would give me pity. Just a slim chance.
He would just squeeze your throat and just be like, done. You're done. You'd be done. Yes. Like, yeah. He would do a very merciful death. Whereas James Johnson, who is a black belt and is undefeated in MMA fighting, and like the Indiana Pacers have him on the roster strictly to intimidate and to protect that roster. That he is. There was a moment, I don't know if you remember this, where there was like a fight out on the floor between, I want to say it was Memphis and Indiana a couple years ago, and Steven Adams and James Johnson like walked towards each other, and it was like almost like we were watching a WWE like standoff. Or I was like, no, like no one's going to survive if these two guys are in a fight together. We cannot have this happen. Someone asked me, when we were doing this chat, I was promoting it, the live show. I was promoting it and saying, like, if you show up late, I'm going to send James Johnson after you. And someone replied, and I'm going to send Isaiah Stewart. And I was like, don't care. That's over in a half a second. James Johnson would destroy him.
Yeah, like Joe Mazzulla talked earlier this season about how the NBA should allow fighting again. Like, if there were a competition among everybody in the NBA, James Johnson wins that. He wins that.
Yeah, Royal Rumble.
Without a question.
Yeah, he's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question about it. So avoid James Johnson in that cage match. I'll take Steven Adams. Kenyon Martin, the lip tattoo scares me. I feel like he'd make you kiss it before he gives you pity. Steven Adams, you know, you get a chance. That he, like you said, he squeezes your neck and then says, okay, I'm done with you. And that's it.
James Johnson's nickname is Bloodsport. I'm not doing anything. Like, I'm not... Bro, like I'm not even messing
avoid,
with that.
Avoid okay? him and at by the way, all costs.
He's got neck tattoos too. So whatever Kenny Martin has, James Johnson has it that much better. He's a deadly force, man. Like I would read, you know, I should probably just write that book, is the James Johnson book. It's an amazing story. And who thought that he would have as long of a career as he's had? And I'm telling you, his fighting skills is a big reason why he's still on an NBA payroll.
Yeah, it definitely is. He's the enforcer. Who doesn't even need to play. He's just his presence. That's enough. Tom, this was fun, man. Thank you for joining me today. And thank you for everybody in the live chat as well who sent in questions ahead of time and during the show. This is fun. I like going live, Tom.
Let's do it again. And then we can talk about the season finale of White Lotus.
Yeah, maybe next Friday we'll be live again. A big thank you to Mike and Emmy and the whole team behind the scenes for producing us, especially during this live show. We have the Final Four this weekend. I'm picking Duke to win it all. I'm sure you still are as well, Tom. But I'm excited for that. We get the final week of the regular season, a whole lot coming up. We'll be covering it all here on the Kevin O'Connor Show. People can listen and watch your show, The Big Number, over with Yahoo Sports as well. Tom, have a great weekend.
You too, bud.
Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll be back again next week.